the loveliest village on the plains. Join us now as we revisit the magic of the golden age of radio. The Auburn University Radio Flyer Theater is on the air.
Hello, friends, and welcome to a special holiday edition of Auburn University's Radio Flyer Theater. I'm your host, Dan LaRocque, and I'm delighted to welcome you to an hour of enchanting stories and music, specially crafted for children of all ages. In partnership with Troy University Public Radio and the College of Liberal Arts, Auburn University's Radio Flyer Theater Company is proud to present five short plays for voices from the extraordinary imaginations of Hans Christian Andersen and O. Henry. We begin with a treasured tale of gifts freely given and received in the true spirit of the season, Hans Christian Andersen's The Elves and the Shoemaker.
Once upon a time, there was a poor shoemaker. He made excellent shoes and worked quite diligently, but even so, he could not earn enough to support himself and his family.
He became so poor that he could not even afford to buy the leather he needed to make shoes. Finally, he had only enough to make one last pair.
He cut them out with great care and put the pieces on his workbench so that he could sew them together the following morning.
Now I wonder, will I ever make another pair of shoes? Once I've sold this pair, I shall need all the money to buy food for my family. I will not be able to buy any new leather.
That night, the shoemaker went to bed a sad and distraught man.
The next morning, he awoke early and went downstairs to his workshop. On his bench, he found an exquisite pair of shoes.
They had small and even stitches, formed so perfectly that he knew he couldn't have produced a better pair himself.
Upon close examination, the shoes proved to be from the very pieces of leather he had set out the night before.
He immediately put the fine pair of shoes in the window of his shop and drew back the blinds.
Who in the world could have done this great service for me?
Even before he could make up an answer, a rich man strode into his shop and bought the shoes, and for a fancy price.
The shoemaker was ecstatic. He immediately went out and purchased plenty of food for his family and some more leather.
That afternoon, he cut out two pairs of shoes and, just as before, laid all the pieces on the bench so that he could sew them the next day. Then he went upstairs to enjoy the good meal with his family.
My goodness, he cried the next morning when he found two pairs of beautifully finished shoes on his workbench. Who could make such fine shoes, and so quickly?
He put them in his shop window, and before long, some wealthy people came in and paid a great deal of money for them. The happy shoemaker went right out and bought even more leather.
For weeks and then months, this continued. Whether the shoemaker cut two pairs or four pairs, the fine new shoes were always ready in the morning.
Soon his small shop was crowded with customers. He cut out many types of shoes: stiff boots lined with fur, delicate slippers for dancers, walking shoes for ladies, tiny shoes for children.
Soon his shoes had bows and laces and buckles of fine silver. The little shop prospered as never before, and its proprietor was soon a rich man himself. His family wanted for nothing.
As the shoemaker and his wife sat by the fire one night, he said, "One of these days I shall have to learn who has been helping us."
"We could hide behind the cupboard in your workroom. That way we could find out just who our helpers are."
And that was just what they did. That evening, when the clock struck 12, the shoemaker and his wife heard a noise.
Two tiny men, each with a bag of tools, were squeezing beneath a crack under the door. Oddest of all, the two elves were stark naked.
The two men clambered onto the workbench and began working. Their little hands stitched and their little hammers tapped ceaselessly the whole night through.
They are so small, and they make such beautiful shoes in no time at all.
Indeed, the elves were the size of his own needles.
Quiet! See how they are cleaning up now?
And in an instant, the two elves had disappeared beneath the door.
The next day, the shoemaker's wife said, "Those little elves have done so much good for us. Since it is nearly Christmas, we should make some gifts for them."
"Yes, I'll make some boots that will fit them, and you make some clothes."
They worked until dawn. On Christmas Eve, the presents were laid out upon the workbench. 2 tiny jackets, 2 pairs of trousers, and 2 little woolen caps.
They also left out a plate of good things to eat and drink. Then they hid once again behind the cupboard and waited to see what would happen.
Just as before, the elves appeared at the stroke of midnight. They jumped onto the bench to begin their work, but when they saw all the presents, they began to laugh and shout with joy.
They tried on all the clothes, then helped themselves to the food and drink.
Then they jumped down and danced excitedly around the workroom and disappeared beneath the door.
After Christmas, the shoemaker cut out his leather as he always had, but the 2 elves never returned.
I believe they have heard us whispering. Elves are so very shy when it comes to people, you know.
I know I will miss their help, but we will manage. The shop is always so busy now. But my stitches will never be as tight and small as theirs.
The shoemaker did indeed continue to prosper, but he and his family always remembered the good elves who had helped them during the hard times.
And each and every Christmas Eve from that year onward, they gathered around the fire to drink a toast to their tiny friends.
The Elves and the Shoemaker featured the voice talents of Shannon Dunlop, Bridget Napick, Mallory Porter, Brooke Spivey, John Tortolot, Kylie Wofford, and Jamie Yates, with technical assistance from Gary Castriota and Taylor Dileski. Next, we turn our attention to a tale of music, art, and true love from the pen of one of the great masters of the short story, O. Henry. As we journey back in time to New York City in the early days of the 20th century, we're reminded that some gifts are indeed always in style. Here now is our Radio Flyer Theater rendition of O. Henry's A Service of Love.
When one loves one's art, no service seems too hard.
That is our premise.
This story shall draw a conclusion from it and show at the same time that the premise is incorrect.
That will be a new thing in logic and a feat in storytelling somewhat older than the Great Wall of China.
Joe Larrabee came out of the cornfields of the Middle West, pulsing with a genius for pictorial art.
At 6, he drew a picture of the town pump with a prominent citizen passing it hastily. This effort was framed and hung in the drugstore window next to an ear of corn with an uneven number of rows.
At 20, he left for New York, with his necktie flowing freely and his savings tied up somewhat closer.
Delia Carruthers did things on the piano so promisingly in a pine tree village in the South that her relatives chipped in enough in her chip hat for her to go north and finish.
They could see her talent, but not her future.
Which is just as well, because that's our story.
Joe and Delia met in a downtown studio where a number of art and music students had gathered to discuss composition, cantatas, Rembrandt, rubato, monotypes, Mozart, and oolong tea.
Joe and Delia became enamored, one of the other.
Or each of the other, as you please.
And in a short time, they were married.
For as we mentioned earlier, when one loves one's art, no service seems too hard.
Mr. and Mrs. Larrabee began housekeeping in a small apartment. It was a lonesome flat, something like the A sharp way down at the left-hand end of the keyboard.
And they were happy, for they had their art, and they had each other. And my advice to the rich young man would be, sell all thou hast and give it to the poor. Janitor for the privilege of living in a flat with your art and your Delia.
Flat dwellers shall endorse our dictum that theirs is the only true happiness. If a home is happy, it cannot fit too close. Let the 4 walls converge if they will, so long as you and your Joe are in between.
Joe was painting in the class of the great magister. You know his fame. His fees are high, his lessons are light, his present fortune is built on his past renown.
Delia was studying under Rosenstock. You know his repute as a disturber of the piano keys, famed as much for muscularity as musicality.
Oh, they were mighty happy. as long as their money lasted.
But let's not be cynical. Their aims were clear and well-defined.
Joe was to become capable very soon of turning out pictures that old gentlemen with thin side whiskers and thick pocketbooks would sandbag one another for the privilege of buying.
And Delia was to become well-versed in music to the point of contempt, so that when she saw even a handful of audience seats unsold, she could have a sore throat and lobster in a private dining room and refuse to go on stage.
But the best, as we see it, was their home life. In their little flat, the ardent, voluble chats after the day's study, the cozy dinners and fresh, light breakfasts.
The interchange of ambitions, ambitions interwoven each with the others, or else inconsiderable, the mutual help and inspiration.
And of course the late night stuffed olives.
And cheese sandwiches.
But after a while, art flagged, as it sometimes does.
Everything going out and nothing coming in, as the vulgarians say.
Money was lacking to pay Mr. Magister and Herr Rosenstock their prices.
But when one loves one's art, no service seems too hard. So Delia decided she must give music lessons to keep the wolf from the door.
For 2 or 3 days, she went out canvassing for pupils. One evening, she came home elated.
Joe, dear, I've a pupil, and oh, the loveliest people, General A.B. Pinckney's daughter on 71st Street. Such a splendid house, Joe. You ought to see the front door. Byzantine, I think you'd call it. And inside? Oh, Joe, I never saw anything like it before. My pupil is his daughter, Clementina. I dearly love her already. She's a delicate thing, dresses always in white, and the sweetest, simplest manners. Only 18 years old. I'm to give 3 lessons a week, and just think, Joe, $5 a lesson. I don't mind it a bit, for when I get 2 or 3 more pupils, I can resume my lessons with Herr Rosenstock. Now, smooth out that wrinkle between your brows, dear, and let's have a nice supper.
That's all right for you, Deal, but how about me? Do you think I'm going to let you hustle for wages while I philander in the regions of high art? Not by the bones of Benvenuto Cellini. I guess I can sell papers or lay cobblestones and bring in a dollar or two.
Delia came and hugged about his neck.
Joe, dear, don't be silly. You must keep on at your studies. It's not as if I'd quit my music and gone to work at something else. While I teach, I learn. I'm always with my music, and we can live as happily as millionaires on $15 a week. You mustn't think of leaving Mr. Magister.
All right, but I hate for you to be giving lessons. It isn't art. Still, you're a dear to do it, and I'm lucky to have you all right.
When one loves one's art, no service seems too hard.
Magister praised the sky in that sketch I made in the park, and Logan gave me permission to hang 2 of them in his shop window. I might sell one if the right kind of moneyed idiot comes along.
I'm sure you will. And now, let's be thankful for General Pinckney and this veal roast.
During all of the next week, the Larrabees had an early breakfast. Joe was enthusiastic about some morning effect sketches he was doing in Central Park, and Delia packed him off, breakfasted, coddled, praised, and kissed at 7 o'clock.
Art is an engaging mistress. It was most times 7 o'clock when he returned in the evening.
At the end of the week, Delia, sweetly proud but languid, triumphantly tossed 3 $5 bills on the tiny center table of the parlor.
Sometimes Clementina tries me. I'm afraid she doesn't practice enough, and I have to tell her the same thing so often. And then she always dresses entirely in white, and that does get monotonous. But General Pinckney is the dearest old man. I wish you could know him, Joe. He comes in sometimes when I'm with Clementina at the piano. He's a widower, you know, and stands there pulling his white goatee. And how are the semiquavers and demi-semiquavers progressing? He always asks. I wish you could see the wainscoting in that drawing room, Joe. And those Russian tapestries. And Clementina has such a funny little cough. I hope she's stronger than she looks. Oh, I really am getting attached to her. She's so gentle and high-bred. And did you know General Pinckney's brother was once minister to Bolivia?
And then Joe, with the air of a Monte Cristo, drew forth a 10, a 5, a 2, and a 1, all legal tender notes, and laid them beside Delia's earnings.
Sold that watercolor of the obelisk to a man from Peoria.
Don't joke with me. Not from Peoria.
All the way. I wish you could see him, Deal. Fat man with a woolen muffler and a quill toothpick. He saw the sketch in Logan's window and thought it was a windmill at first. He was game, though, and he bought it anyhow. He ordered another, an oil sketch of the Lackawanna Freight Depot, to take back with him. So I guess art is running neck and neck with music lessons.
I'm so glad you've kept on. You're bound to win, dear. $33. We've never had so much to spend before. We'll have oysters tonight.
And filet mignon with mushroom sauce. Where's the olive fork?
On the next Saturday evening, Joe reached home first. He spread his $18 on the parlor table and washed what seemed to be a great deal of dark paint from his hands.
Half an hour later, Delia arrived, her right hand tied up in a shapeless bundle of wraps and bandages.
What happened?
Delia laughed, but not very joyously.
Clementina insisted upon a Welsh rabbit stew after her lesson. She's such an odd girl. Welsh rabbits at 5 p.m. The general was there. You should have seen him running for the chafing dish, Joe, just as if there wasn't a servant in the house. I know Clementina isn't in good health. She's so nervous. In serving the rabbit, she spilled a great lot of it, boiling hot, over my hand and wrist. It hurt awfully, Joe. And the dear girl was so sorry. But General Pinckney, Joe, that old man nearly went distracted. He rushed downstairs and sent somebody, they said the furnace man or somebody in the basement, out to a drugstore for some oil and things to bind it up with. It doesn't hurt so much now.
Joe took her hand tenderly and pulled at some white strands beneath the bandages.
What's this?
It's something soft that had oil on it. Oh, Joe, did you sell another sketch?
Did I? Just ask the man from Peoria. He got his depot today, and he isn't sure, but he thinks he wants another parkscape and a view on the Hudson. What time this afternoon did you burn your hand, Deal?
5 o'clock, I think. The rabbit came off the fire about that time. You ought to have seen General Pinckney, Joe, when...
Sit down here for a moment, Deal.
He drew her to the couch, sat beside her, and put his arm across her shoulders.
What have you been doing for the past 2 weeks, Deal?
She braved it for a moment or two with an eye full of love and stubbornness, and murmured a phrase or two vaguely of General Pinckney. But at length, down went her head, and out came the truth and the tears.
I couldn't get any pupils, and I couldn't bear to have you give up your lessons, and I got a place ironing shirts in that big 24th Street laundry. And I think I did very well to make up both General Pinckney and Clementina, don't you, Joe? And when the girl in the laundry set down a hot iron on my hand this afternoon, I was all the way home making up that story about the Welsh rabbit. You're not angry, are you, Joe? And if I hadn't got the work, you mightn't have sold your sketches to that man from Peoria.
He wasn't from Peoria.
Well, it doesn't matter where he was from. How clever you are, Joe, and kiss me, Joe. And what made you suspect that I wasn't giving lessons to Clementina?
I didn't until tonight. And I wouldn't have then, only I sent up this cotton waste and oil from the engine room this afternoon for a girl upstairs who had her hand burned with a smoothing iron. I've been firing the engine in the laundry for the last 2 weeks.
And then you didn't...
My purchaser from Peoria and General Pinckney are both creations of the same art, but you wouldn't call it either painting or music.
And then they both laughed, and Joe began...
When one loves one's art, no service seems...
But Delia stopped him. With her hand on his lips.
No, just when one loves.
A Service of Love was recorded before a live audience at the Auburn Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and featured the voice talents of Carrie Daniel, Deidre Haig, Garrett Keller, and Chris Qualls. Musical accompaniment was provided by Adrian Wilson. Thank you. Our next offering features one of Hans Christian Andersen's most haunting tales of hope in the face of great difficulty as seen through the eyes of a loving child. This story reminds us that especially in a season that Dickens described as a time of all others, when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices, that mankind is our business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence are all our business. Here now is the Auburn University Radio Flyer Theater rendition of Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Matchstick Girl.
Most terribly cold it was. It snowed and was nearly quite dark. And evening, the last evening of the year.
In this cold and darkness, there went along the street a poor little girl, bareheaded and with naked feet.
When she left home, she had slippers on, it is true, but what was the good of that?
They were very large slippers, which her mother had worn before her, and the poor little thing lost them as she scuffled away across the street because of two carriages that rolled by dreadfully fast.
One slipper was nowhere to be found.
The other had been laid hold of by an urchin, and off he ran with it. He thought it would do capitally for a cradle when he someday or other should have children himself.
So the little maiden walked on with her tiny naked feet that were quite red and blue from the cold.
She carried a quantity of matches in an old apron, and she held a bundle of them in her hand. Nobody had bought anything of her the whole livelong day. No one had given her a single farthing.
She crept along trembling with cold and hunger. A very picture of sorrow, the poor little thing.
The flakes of snow covered her long, fair hair, which fell in beautiful curls around her neck. But of that, of course, she never once now thought.
From all the windows, the candles were gleaming, and it smelt so deliciously of roast goose, for you know it was New Year's Eve. Yes, of that she thought.
In a corner formed by two houses, one of which advanced more than the other, she seated herself down and cowered together.
Her little feet she had drawn close up to her, but she grew colder and colder, and to go home she did not venture, for she had not sold any matches and could not bring a farthing of money.
From her father she would certainly get blows. And at home it was cold too, for above her she had only the roof, through which the wind whistled, even though the largest cracks were stopped up with straw and rags.
Her little hands were almost numbed with cold.
Oh, a match might afford her a world of comfort. If only she dared take a single one out of the bundle, draw it against the wall, and warm her fingers by it.
She drew one out. Whish! How it blazed, how it burnt! It was a warm, bright flame like a candle as she held her hands over it. It was a wonderful light.
It seemed really to the little maiden as though she were sitting before a large iron stove with burnished brass feet and a brass ornament at top. The fire burned with such blessed influence. It warmed so delightfully.
The little girl had already stretched out her feet to warm them too, but the match went out. The stove vanished. She had only the remains of the burnt-out match in her hand.
She rubbed another against the wall. It burned brightly, and where the light fell on the wall, there the wall became transparent like a veil, so that she could see into the room.
On the table was spread a snow-white tablecloth. Upon it was a splendid porcelain service, and the roast goose was steaming famously with its stuffing of apple and dried plums.
And what was still more capital to behold was, the goose hopped down from the dish, reeled about on the floor with a knife and fork in its breast, till it came up to the poor little girl, when
the match went out, and nothing but the thick, cold, damp wall was left behind.
She lighted another match.
Now, there she was, sitting under the most magnificent Christmas tree. It was still larger and more decorated than the one which she had seen through the glass door in the rich merchant's house.
Thousands of lights were burning on the green branches, and gaily colored pictures such as she had seen in shop windows looked down upon her.
The little maiden stretched out her hands towards them when
the match went out.
The lights of the Christmas tree seemed to rise higher and higher, so high that she saw them now as stars in heaven. One fell down and formed a long trail of fire.
Someone has just died, said the little girl.
For her old grandmother, the only person who had loved her, and who was now no more, had told her that when a star falls, a soul ascends to God.
She drew another match against the wall. It was again light, and in the luster there stood the old grandmother, so bright and radiant, so mild, and with such an expression of love.
Grandmother! Oh, take me with you! You go away when the match burns out. You vanish like the warm stove, like the delicious roast goose, and like the magnificent Christmas tree.
And she rubbed the whole bundle of matches quickly against the wall, for she wanted to be quite sure of keeping her grandmother near her.
And the matches gave such a brilliant light that it was brighter than at noonday. Never formerly had the grandmother been so beautiful and tall.
She took the little maiden on her arm, and both flew in brightness and in joy so high, so very high.
And then above was neither cold, nor hunger, nor anxiety. They were with God.
But in the corner at the cold hour of dawn sat the poor girl, with rosy cheeks and with a smiling mouth, leaning against the wall, frozen to death on the last evening of the old year.
Stiff and stark sat the child there with her matches, of which one bundle had been burnt. She wanted to warm herself, people said.
No one had the slightest suspicion of what beautiful things she had seen.
No one even dreamed of the splendor in which, with her grandmother, she had entered on the joys of a new year.
The Little Matchstick Girl featured the voice talents of Mallory Hammond, Becky Sheehan, and Cree Woods, with technical assistance from Taylor Dolesky and Gary Castriota. We return now to O. Henry's Old New York in the early 1900s in a tale of adventure and romance. This story was included in a collection O. Henry titled The 4 Million. In his introduction to this volume of classic short stories, the author makes reference to a comment by New York Society gatekeeper Ward McAllister, who claimed that only 400 people in all of New York were actually worthy of note. O. Henry countered that the census taker begged to differ, and this collection was his effort to celebrate the other 3,999,600 stories he felt were truly worth telling. Here now is our Radio Flyer Theater rendition of O. Henry's The Green Door.
Suppose you should be walking down Broadway after dinner with 10 minutes allotted to the consummation of your cigar while you're choosing between a diverting tragedy and something serious in the way of vaudeville.
Suddenly, a hand is laid upon your arm.
You turn to look into the thrilling eyes of a beautiful woman, wonderful in diamonds and Russian sables.
She thrusts frantically into your hand an extremely hot buttered roll, flashes out a tiny pair of scissors, snips off the second button of your overcoat, cryptically utters but one word,
parallelogram,
and swiftly flies down a cross street, looking back fearfully over her shoulder.
That would be pure adventure. Would you accept it?
Not you. You would flush with embarrassment. You would sheepishly drop the roll and continue down Broadway, fumbling feebly for the missing button. This you would do unless you are one of the blessed few in whom the pure spirit of adventure is not dead.
True adventurers have never been plentiful. Those who've been chronicled in print as such have been mostly businessmen with newly invented methods. They've gone after the things they wanted. Golden fleeces, holy grails, lady loves, treasure, crowns, and fame.
The true adventurer goes forth aimless and uncalculating to meet and greet an unknown fate. A fine example was the prodigal son when he started back home.
Half-adventurers, brave and splendid figures, have been numerous. From the Crusades to the Alamo, they have enriched the arts of history and fiction, and the trade of historical fiction.
But each of them had a prize to win, a goal to kick, an axe to grind, a race to run, the next big thing to deliver, a name to carve. So they were not followers of true adventure.
In the big city, the twin spirits, romance and adventure, are always abroad, seeking worthy wooers.
As we roam the streets, they slyly peep at us and challenge us in 20 different guises.
Without knowing why, we look up suddenly to see in a window a face that seems to belong to our gallery of intimate portraits.
Instead of at our familiar curb, a cab driver deposits us before a strange door, which one, with a smile, opens for us and bids us enter.
A slip of paper written upon flutters down to our feet from the upper latitudes of chance.
At every corner, handkerchiefs drop, fingers beckon, eyes besiege, and the lost, the lonely, the rapturous, the mysterious, the perilous changing clues of adventure are slipped into our fingers.
But few of us are willing to hold and follow them. We are grown stiff with the ramrod of convention down our backs. We pass on, and someday we come at the end of a very dull life to reflect that for us, adventure and romance has been a pallid thing. Of a marriage or two, a satin rosette kept in a safe deposit drawer, and a lifelong feud with the neighbor's cat.
But Rudolf Steiner was a true adventurer. Few were the evenings on which he did not go forth from his hall bedchamber in search of the unexpected and the outrageous.
The most interesting thing in life seemed to him to be what might lie just around the next corner.
Sometimes his willingness to tempt fate led him into strange paths. Twice he had spent the night in a police station.
Again and again he found himself the dupe of ingenious and mercenary tricksters. His watch and money had been the price of one flattering allurement.
But with undiminished ardor, he picked up every glove cast before him, striding boldly into the merry lists of adventure.
One evening, Rudolf was strolling along a cross street in the older central part of the city. Two streams of people filled the sidewalks, the home hurrying and the restless contingent that abandons home for the specious welcome of the brightly lit eating establishment.
The young adventurer was of pleasing presence and moved serenely and watchfully.
By daylight, he was a salesman in a piano store. He wore his tie drawn through a topaz ring instead of fastened with a stick pin, and once he had written to the editor of a magazine that Sense and Sensibility, by Miss Austen, had been the book that most influenced his life.
During his walk, a violent chattering of teeth in a glass case on the sidewalk seemed at first to draw his attention to a restaurant before which it was set. But a second glance revealed the electric letters of a dentist's sign high above the next door.
A towering African man, fantastically dressed in a red embroidered coat, yellow trousers, and a military cap, discreetly distributed cards to those of the passing crowd who consented to take them.
This mode of dentistic advertising was a common sight to Rudolph. Usually he passed the dispenser of the dentist cards without reducing his supply.
But tonight, the African slipped one into his hand so deftly that Rudolph retained it there, smiling a little at the successful feat.
When he had traveled a few yards further, he glanced at the card indifferently. Surprised, he turned it over and looked again with interest.
One side of the card was blank. On the other was written in ink three words, "The Green Door."
And then Rudolph saw, three steps in front of him, a man throw down the card the African had given him as he passed.
Rudolph picked it up. It was printed with the dentist's name and address and the usual schedule of plate work and bridge work and crowns and dubious promises of painless operations.
The adventurous piano salesman halted at the corner and considered. Then he crossed the street, walked down a block, recrossed, and joined the upward current of people again.
Without seeming to notice the African as he passed the second time, he carelessly took the card that was handed him.
10 steps away, he inspected it. In the same handwriting that appeared on the first card, "The Green Door" was inscribed upon it.
3 or 4 cards were tossed to the pavement by pedestrians both following and leading him. These fell blank side up.
Rudolph turned them over. Every one bore the printed services of the dental parlors.
Rarely did the arch sprite adventure need to beckon twice to Rudolf Steiner, his true follower, but twice it had done so, and the quest was on.
Rudolf walked slowly back to where the giant African stood by the case of rattling teeth. This time as he passed, he received no card.
In spite of his gaudy and ridiculous garb, the Ethiopian displayed a natural dignity as he stood, offering the card suavely to some, allowing others to pass unmolested.
Every half minute he chanted a harsh, unintelligible phrase akin to the jabber of car conductors in grand opera. And not only did he withhold a card this time, but it seemed to Rudolf that he received from the shining and massive black countenance a look of cold, almost contemptuous disdain.
The look stung the adventurer. He read in it a silent accusation that he had been found wanting. Whatever the mysterious written words on the cards might mean, the African siren had selected him twice from the throng for their recipient, and now seemed to have condemned him as deficient in the wit and spirit to answer the siren's call.
Standing aside from the rush, the young man made a rapid estimate of the building in which he conceived that his adventure must lie. 5 stories high it rose. A small restaurant occupied the basement.
The first floor, now closed, seemed to house women's hats or furs. The second floor, by the winking electric letters, was the dentist.
Above this, a competing gaggle of signs struggled to indicate the abodes of palmists, dressmakers, musicians, and doctors.
Still higher up, draped curtains and milk bottles, white on the windowsills, proclaimed the regions of domesticity.
After concluding his survey, Rudolf walked briskly up the high flight of stone steps and into the house.
Up 2 flights of the carpeted stairway he continued, and at its top, paused.
The hallway there was dimly lighted by 2 pale jets of gas, one far to his right, the other nearer to his left.
He looked toward the nearer light and saw within its pale halo a green door.
For 1 moment, he hesitated.
Then he seemed to see the contemptuous sneer of the African juggler of cards.
And then he walked straight to the green door and knocked against it.
Moments like those that passed before his knock was answered measured the quick breath of true adventure. What might not be behind those green panels?
Gamesters at play? Cunning rogues baiting their traps with subtle skill? Beauty in love with courage and thus planning to be sought by it?
Danger, death, love, disappointment, ridicule. Any of these might respond to that impetuous rap.
A faint rustle was heard inside, and the door slowly opened.
A girl, not yet 20, stood there, white-faced and tottering. She loosed the knob and swayed weakly, groping with 1 hand.
Rudolf caught her and laid her on a faded couch that stood against the wall. He closed the door and took a swift glance around the room by the light of a flickering gas jet.
Neat but extreme poverty was the story that he read.
The girl lay still, as if in a faint.
Rudolf looked around the room excitedly for a barrel. People must be rolled upon a barrel who... No. No, that was for drowned persons. He began to fan her with his hat.
That was successful, for he struck her nose with the brim of his derby, and she opened her eyes.
And then the young man saw that hers indeed was the one missing face from his heart's gallery of intimate portraits.
The frank gray eyes, the little nose turning pertly outward, the chestnut hair curling like the tendrils of a pea vine, all seemed the right end and reward for all the wonderful adventures. But the face was woefully thin and pale.
The girl looked at him calmly and then smiled.
Fainted, didn't I? Well, who wouldn't? You try going without anything to eat for 3 days and see.
Oh, good heavens! Wait till I come back.
He dashed out the green door and down the stairs. In 20 minutes, he was back again, kicking at the door with his toe for her to open it.
With both arms, he hugged an array of wares from the grocery and the restaurant. On the table, he laid them. Bread and butter, cold meats, cakes, pies, pickles, oysters, a roasted chicken, a bottle of milk, and 1 of red-hot tea.
This is ridiculous. To go without eating? You must quit tempting fate in this fashion. Supper is ready.
He helped her to a chair at the table.
Is there a cup for the tea?
On the shelf by the window.
When he turned again with the cup, he saw her, with eyes shining rapturously, beginning upon a huge dill pickle that she had rooted out from the paper bags with a woman's unerring instinct.
He took it from her laughingly and poured the cup full of milk.
Drink that first, and then you shall have some tea, and then a chicken wing. If you are very good, you shall have a pickle tomorrow. And now, if you'll allow me to be your guest, we'll have supper.
He drew up the other chair. The tea brightened the girl's eyes and brought back some of her color.
She began to eat with a sort of dainty ferocity, like some starved but elegant wild animal.
She seemed to regard the young man's presence and the aid he had rendered her as a natural thing, not as though she undervalued the mannerly conventions, but as one whose great stress gave her the right to put aside the artificial for the human.
But gradually, with the return of strength and comfort, came also a sense of the little conventions that belong, and she began to tell him her little story.
It was one of a thousand such as the city yawns at every day. The shop girl's story of insufficient wages, further reduced by fines that go to swell the store's profits, of time lost through illness, and then of lost positions, lost hope, and finally, the knock of the adventurer upon the green door.
But to Rudolph, the history sounded as big as the Iliad, or as dire as Marianne's crisis in Sense and Sensibility.
To think of you going through all that.
It was something fierce.
And you have no relatives or friends in the city?
None whatever.
I am all alone in the world, too.
I'm glad of that.
And somehow, it pleased the young man to hear that she approved of his bereft condition.
Very suddenly, her eyelids drooped, and she sighed deeply.
I'm awfully sleepy, and I feel so good.
Then Rudolph rose and took his hat.
I'll say good night. A long night's sleep will be fine for you.
He held out his hand.
And she took it and said, good night.
But her eyes asked a question so eloquently, so frankly and pathetically, that he answered it with words.
Oh, I'm coming back tomorrow to see how you're getting along. You can't get rid of me so easily.
Then, at the door, as though the way of his coming had been so much less important than the fact that he had come, she asked,
how did you come to knock at my door?
He looked at her for a moment, remembering the cards, and felt a sudden jealous pain.
What if they had fallen into other hands as adventurous as his?
Quickly, he decided that she must never know the truth. He would never let her know that he was aware of the strange necessity to which she had been driven by her great distress.
One of our piano tuners lives in this house. I knocked at your door by mistake.
The last thing he saw in the room before the green door closed was her smile.
At the head of the stairway, he paused and looked curiously about him. And then he went along the hallway to its other end, and coming back, ascended to the floor above and continued his puzzled explorations.
Every door that he found in the house was painted green.
Wondering, he descended to the sidewalk. The fantastic African was still there. Rudolph confronted him with his two cards in his hand.
Will you tell me why you gave me these cards and what they mean?
In a broad, good-natured grin, the African exhibited a splendid advertisement of his employer's profession.
That it is, sir. But I expect you is a little late for the first act.
Looking the way he pointed, Rudolph saw, above the entrance to a theater, the blazing electric sign of its new play, The Green Door.
I'm informed that it's a first-rate show, sir. The agent what presented me with $1, sir, to distribute a few of his cards along with the doctor's. May I offer you one of the doctor's cards, sir?
At the corner of the block in which Rudolph lived, he stopped for a glass of beer and a cigar.
When he emerged a while later, he buttoned his coat, pushed back his hat, and said stoutly to the lamppost on the corner,
all the same, I believe it was the hand of fate that led me to her.
Which conclusion, under the circumstances, certainly admits Rudolph Steiner to the ranks of the true followers of romance and adventure.
The Green Door was recorded before a live audience at the Auburn Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and featured the voice talents of Deidre Haig, Alan King, Jordan Lunstead, Chris Qualls, and Anna Claire Walker. Musical accompaniment was provided by Adrian Wilson. The final offering features one of Hans Christian Andersen's most beloved tales of all time. As we revisit the Emperor and his kingdom at this particular time of year, it's always an added delight to remember that often it is indeed a little child who leads us. Here now is our Radio Flyer Theater rendition of The Emperor's New Clothes.
Many years ago lived an emperor. Who thought so much of new clothes, he spent all his money in order to obtain them. His only ambition was to always be well-dressed.
He did not care for his soldiers. And the theater did not amuse him. The only thing, in fact, he thought anything of was to drive out and show off a new suit of clothes.
He had a coat for every hour of the day. And as one would say of a king, he is in his cabinet. So one could say of him, the emperor is in his dressing room.
The great city where he resided was very genial. Every day, many strangers from all parts of the globe arrived.
One day, two swindlers came to this city. They made people believe that they were weavers and declared they could manufacture the finest cloth to be imagined.
Their colors and patterns, they said, were not only exceptionally beautiful, but the clothes made of their material possessed the wonderful quality of being invisible to any man who was unfit for his office or unpardonably stupid.
That must be a wonderful cloth, thought the emperor.
Dun, da, da, da.
If I were to be dressed in a suit made of this cloth, I should be able to find out which men in my empire were unfit for their places. And I could distinguish the clever from the stupid. I must have this cloth woven for me without delay.
And he gave a large sum of money to the swindlers in advance that they should set to work without any loss of time. They set up two looms and pretended to be very hard at work, but they did nothing whatever on the looms. They asked for the finest silk and the most precious gold cloth. All they got, they did away with, and worked at the empty looms till late at night.
I should very much like to know how they are getting on with the cloth, thought the emperor.
Dun, da, da, da.
But he felt rather uneasy when he remembered that he who was not fit for his office could not see it.
Personally, he was of the opinion that he had nothing to fear. Yet he thought it advisable to send somebody else first to see how matters stood.
Everybody in the town knew what a remarkable quality the stuff possessed, and all were anxious to see how bad or stupid their neighbors were.
I shall send my honest old minister to the weavers, thought the emperor. She can judge best how the stuff looks, for she is intelligent, and nobody understands her office better than she.
The good old minister went into the room where the swindlers sat before the empty looms.
Heaven preserve us, she thought, and opened her eyes wide. I cannot see anything at all. But she did not say so.
Both swindlers requested her to come near and asked her if she did not admire the exquisite pattern.
Ooh.
And the beautiful colors.
Ah.
Pointing to the empty looms.
The poor old minister tried her very best, but she could see nothing, for there was nothing to be seen.
Oh dear, she thought. Can I be so stupid? I should never have thought so, and nobody must know it. Is it possible that I am not fit for my office? No. No, I cannot say I was unable to see the cloth.
Now, have you got nothing to say?
said one of the swindlers while he pretended to be busily weaving.
Oh, it is very pretty, exceedingly beautiful, replied the old minister, looking through her glasses. What a beautiful pattern.
Ooh.
What brilliant colors.
Oh.
I shall tell the emperor that I like the cloth very much.
We are pleased to hear that, said the weavers, and they described to her the colors.
Ooh.
And explained the curious pattern.
Ah.
The old minister listened attentively that she might relate to the emperor what they said, and so she did.
Now the swindlers asked for more money, silk, and gold cloth, which they required for weaving.
They kept everything for themselves, and not a thread came near the loom, but they continued, as hitherto, to work at the empty looms.
Soon afterwards, the emperor sent another honest courtier to the weavers to see how they were getting on, and if the cloth was nearly finished.
Like the old minister, he looked and looked, but could see nothing, as there was nothing to be seen.
Is it not a beautiful piece of cloth? Asked the two swindlers, showing and explaining the magnificent pattern, which, however, did not exist.
I am not stupid, said the man. It is therefore my good appointment for which I am not fit, which is very strange. I must not let anyone know of it.
And he praised the cloth, which he did not see, and expressed his joy at the beautiful colors.
Ooh.
And the fine pattern.
Ah.
It is very excellent, he said to the emperor.
Everybody in the whole town was talking about the precious cloth, and at last the emperor wished to see it himself, while it was still on the loom. With a number of courtiers, including the two who had already been there, he went to the two clever swindlers, who now worked as hard as they could, but without using any thread.
Is it not magnificent?
Said the two old courtiers who had been there before.
Your Majesty must admire the colors.
Ooh.
And the pattern.
Ah.
And they pointed to the empty looms, for they imagined the others could see the cloth.
What is this? Thought the emperor. I do not see anything at all. That is terrible. Am I stupid? Am I unfit to be emperor? That would indeed be the most dreadful thing that could happen to me. Really, he said, turning to the weavers, your cloth has our most gracious approval. And nodding contentedly, he looked at the empty loom, for he did not like to say that he saw nothing.
All his attendants who were with him looked and looked, and although they could not see anything more than the others, they said, like the emperor,
it is very beautiful.
And all advised him to wear the new magnificent clothes at a great procession which was soon to take place.
It is magnificent, beautiful, excellent.
Everybody seemed to be delighted, and the emperor appointed the two swindlers imperial court weavers.
The whole night previous to the day on which the procession was to take place, the swindlers pretended to work and burned more than 16 candles. People should see that they were busy to finish the emperor's new suit.
They pretended to take the cloth from the loom and worked about it in the air with big scissors and sewed with needles without thread, and said at last,
the emperor's new suit is ready now.
Hooray! The emperor and all his barons then came to the hall.
The swindlers held their arms up as if they held something in their hands and said,
these are the trousers.
Ooh.
This is the coat.
Ah.
Here is the cloak.
Ooh.
They're all as light as cobweb, and one must feel as if one had nothing at all upon the body. But that is just the beauty of them.
Ah.
Indeed, said all the courtiers. But they could not see anything, for there was nothing to be seen.
Does it please your majesty now to graciously undress, said the swindlers, that we may assist your majesty in putting on the new suit before the large looking glass?
The emperor undressed, and the swindlers pretended to put the new suit upon him, one piece after another, and the emperor looked at himself in the glass from every side.
Ooh, how well they look! How well they fit! Ooh, what a beautiful pattern.
Ooh.
What fine colors.
Ah.
That is a magnificent suit of clothes.
The master of ceremonies announced that the bearers of the canopy, which was to be carried in the procession, were ready.
I am ready, said the emperor. Does not my suit fit me marvelously? Then he turned once more to the looking glass, that people should think he admired his garments.
The chamberlains, who were to carry the train, stretched their hands to the ground as if they lifted up a train, and pretended to hold something in their hands. They did not like people to know that they could not see anything.
The emperor marched in the procession under the beautiful canopy, and all who saw him in the street and out of the windows exclaimed,
"Indeed, the emperor's new suit is incomparable.
What a long train he has.
How well it fits him."
Nobody wished to let the others know he saw nothing, for then he would have been unfit for his office or too stupid.
Never an emperor's clothes were more admired.
When all at once a little child cried out,
"But he has nothing on at all."
"Good heavens! Listen to the voice of an innocent child," said his mother.
And one whispered to the other what the child had said.
At last, the whole people began to laugh and cried out,
"But he has nothing on at all."
That made a deep impression upon the emperor, for it seemed to him that they were right. But he thought to himself, "Now I must bear up to the end."
And the chamberlains walked with still greater dignity,
as if they carried the emperor's train,
which did not exist.
The Emperor's New Clothes featured the voice talents of Kat Grilly, Kristen Hopkins, Payne Hopton-Jones, and Emily Stevens, with technical assistance from Stuart Ives. That concludes this ride on the Auburn University Radio Flyer. Special thanks to Kyle Gassett and Troy University Public Radio, Auburn University's College of Liberal Arts and Department of Theater, the Auburn Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and the East Alabama Arts Association for their support. Today's program was recorded and produced by Kelly Walker. I'm your host, Dan LaRocque, wishing you a hearty, happy holiday season from the Auburn family to yours. And as always, thanks for listening.
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Who comes around on a special night? Boots and a suit of red.
Santa wears boots and a suit of red.
Who wears a long cap on his head?
Santa wears a long cap on his head.
Cap on head, suit that's red. Special night, a beard that's white. Must be Santa, must be Santa, must be Santa, Santa Claus. Who's got a big red cherry nose?
Santa's got a big red cherry nose.
Who laughs this way, ho ho ho?
Come on.